Hello, this is Laurie Sanderson, Executive Director of the Ziegfeld Club. I am interviewing today the authors Cynthia Brideson and Sarah Brideson, the authors of Ziegfeld and His Follies, a remarkable biography of Broadway's greatest producer, Florence Ziegfeld, which was released this summer. Hello, Cynthia and Sarah. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for interviewing us. Thank you.
Thank you. So I'm calling you in, you're in California?
Yes, Sacramento, California.
Oh, very nice. I'm in New York City, so we're talking to one another across the country. Ziegfeld would have loved that. So
yes, he definitely would.
He would. And you guys are the expert on Ziegfeld and His Follies, Billy Burke and the world around him, Anna Held and Lillian Lorraine. So there's so much that we could discuss. I just want to start by saying that I was up all night reading your book the first day I received it, and I've referred to it and read it so many times. I just love it. So thank you in 2015 for telling the story of this remarkable man. I direct a not-for-profit called the Ziegfeld Club, and I share the passion that you have for Broadway's greatest producer. And so tell me how it is that you came to this subject and decided to write this, and then tell me a little bit about how you did research.
We came to the subject of Ziegfeld when we were very young. We're 25 now, but we've been studying him since we were 8 years old, and we discovered him through Billy Burke because we were obsessed with The Wizard of Oz as children. So we decided to find out everything we could about Billy Burke, who played Glinda the Good Witch. So we went to the library, got her autobiography, and it was full of stuff about someone named Ziegfeld. So then we found everything we could about Ziegfeld, and from that time on, we've just been really fascinated with his work and his shows. And we've been researching for, I guess, like 17 years.
And the research you did was in your library, and you also came to New York, right?
We were not able to go personally to New York, but we hired a virtual research assistant to go into the Anna Held papers at the New York Public Library, where there was voluminous correspondence between Ziegfeld and Billy Burke and Patricia. That was my favorite part of the research, actually, finding letters between Ziegfeld and daughter Patricia when she was a little girl. It was just a really sweet side to him that we totally didn't expect. And the letters between him and Billy Burke were, you could really, she was so different from how she was on screen. She was very serious and opinionated and very smart, not at all like the fluttery matron she played on screen. So we were just so appreciative to the New York Public Library for having that virtual research assistant help us. That was great.
That's amazing. And you really do see the side of Florence Ziegfeld with his daughter in your book, with Patricia. It really shows what a caring, passionate father he was and how his heart was so huge. And I also think, like, he changed a lot once he became a father, right? I mean, he became much more, you know, less of a man about town, and he really became more of a family man once he became a father. Don't you agree?
I do, and even the tone of his shows changed a bit after he was a father. There had been a bit of nudity in his show previously to his having a daughter, but after that and after the objection of his best friend, Will Rogers, that ended. And also he liked staying around the house more. He wasn't keeping two different residences all the time, although he did spend many a night in New York when his shows were running, but he just really liked returning home to Berkeley Crest. It was his haven.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. He had kept the Ansonia, the apartment in the Ansonia, right? But he wasn't spending as much time there? at that time, around those years. Mm-hmm. And yeah, with the nudity in the shows in the beginning, in the early years, what did you find in your research about that? Because I was always told that there was allowed to be nudity as long as it was in tableau, as long as the performers didn't move. Is that what you had found as well?
Yes, definitely found that as long as the woman, the undressed woman, was not moving, it was acceptable because it was more like a statue at that point. And we've still never used vulgar nudity. He always presented any suggestive outfits in a artistic manner, like you could be in ancient Rome or Greece. So that's what he, you know, the kind of more girly show is what a lot of people associate with the Ziegfeld Follies, but there is so much more to them than that. There's top-notch comedy and satire on current events, and top-notch music by people like Irving Berlin and George Gershwin and Jerome Kern. He really, it was a very well-rounded type of show, and not just a parade of showgirls and scanty clothing, that's for sure.
Well, I mean, with Ned Wayburn's choreography and the Ziegfeld Walk and what they were creating on the stage of the New Am and the other theaters where Ziegfeld performed either in New York or on the road, there was great diversity and great, everything was very new. And like I always say, I mean, I feel that Dolores was the first supermodel. In the White Peacock, because she was, modeling for Lucille of London when Ziegfeld first saw her, and Lucille had done Billy Burke's clothes.
But Dolores was she began the Ziegfeld Walk and was one of the first famous showgirls who was truly I would agree that she was the first supermodel, that's for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, she really was, and Ziegfeld created her. And there were so many firsts, I think, in the Ziegfeld Follies. I mean, look at Will Rogers. He's a lot like Jon Stewart. I mean, he was the first, you know, he was taking content and creating material for that evening's performance from the newspapers of the day. And, you know, he was really, I think, the way super, super ahead of his time and I mean, from what I understood, Ziegfeld wasn't so crazy about Will Rogers in the beginning. You know, he thought when he had him in the Midnight Frolic on the roof of the New Amsterdam, you know, that the audiences wouldn't really take to this cowboy and all that, but they ended up loving him. And can you talk anything about Will Rogers and Ziegfeld's relationship, friendship?
Yes, well, that was one of our favorite parts of researching. Also, Will Rogers is a particular favorite of ours.
Me too.
He and Ziegfeld shared a love of the outdoors and the simple life. It's amazing to think that Ziegfeld actually loved the simple life, but he liked roughing it out in the woods and cooking over a campfire. And he and Will Rogers shared that, and they liked to ride horses together on Will Rogers' ranch. And he and Billy Burke, Will Rogers and Billy Burke had a close friendship as well, and their entire families just were kind of like family to each other. The kids played together, and Ziegfeld always had he showed his sense of humor in front of Will Rogers. He often said, "I have no sense of humor," but with Will Rogers, he was able to joke around, and he often said, "Will Rogers is the only comedian who makes me not want to hide in my office." So they just kind of, yeah. So they had a really warm relationship, and even after Ziegfeld's death, Will Rogers, I think, was the most affected by it, except for Billy Burke, of course, and he helped arrange all the funeral and the costs, and he even helped Billy Burke along in Hollywood and starred with her in Doubting Thomas, a great little comedy from, I think it was 1935. It was actually Will, I think it was his final film before he died, so it's a really good piece of history there to see two true friends, you know, playing off of each other. You can just feel the warmth there.
That's so nice. That is true. He was a good friend. He also spoke at Ziegfeld's memorial.
Yes, he was the primary speaker there, and I think his last line in his eulogy was, "You can't kill magic," because he said that Ziegfeld's work was magic, and you know, that can never die, and I believe that.
Mm-hmm. And he also said that I owe everything to Florin Ziegfeld except meeting my wife. Because Ravage's wife was not in the Ziegfeld Follies. So that's just hilarious and wonderful. And can you tell us a little bit more about Billy Burke, what you found out? I mean, we're talking about the orbit around Ziegfeld and not as much about Ziegfeld, but I'm curious to see what about Billy?
Billy Burke was definitely the most important woman in his life, and they met in 1914. They were about 20 years apart in age, but their marriage lasted, and she was very more realistic while he was kind of more of a dreamer. She was worried about finances and not overspending, and it would infuriate her when he gambled because he was a big gambler, and she even packed her bags and almost left him once when he lost hundreds of thousands of dollars gambling. But she was very patient. She put up with some of his infidelities, and she put up with his gambling, but she just loved him. And after a while, he kind of realized, you know, this is amazing that she's sticking with me through this. And he eventually kind of settled down, stopped having affairs, and stopped gambling, and he just settled into a family life with her. And their early marriage was kind of contentious. Like, she would throw china at him or hit him over the head with a soup bowl or tear curtains down if she heard rumors that he was having an affair. So she had many sides to her, but overall she was just a very steadying presence in his life. She really helped his career.
He believed in her as a performer. I mean, when they met on it was New Year's Eve, right? She was Somerset Maugham's date at a New Year's Eve party, and he was Lillian Lorraine had left in his girlfriend or performer Lillian Lorraine had left in a bit of a storm, and then he met Billy Burke that night. The story goes, right?
Yes, that's true. And he did believe in her as a performer. He produced several shows for her, even musicals. One of them was called Annie Dear, and he helped her get started in films too. He produced a series of short silent films called Gloria's Romance for her. So he definitely thought of her as a great performer.
Mm-hmm. And what about Lillian Lorraine and Ziegfeld?
Lorraine Ziegfeld had, she was kind of sometimes was cast as the villain in his marriage to Anna Held, because she sort of was responsible for breaking up the marriage. But she and Ziegfeld did have an affair during his and Anna Held's common law marriage in the 1910s, and he actually kept a hotel room for Lillian Lorraine on the floor above his and Anna Held's suite. So that was very gutsy of him to maintain a home for her right above the home with him and Anna. But he thought that she was, you know, just the most beautiful girl in the world, and he believed that she had talent, even though most people said she's stupid, she's just pretty, she doesn't have any talent. But he showcased her so that she really came across on stage and just became this phenomenon. And he kind of helped support her for the rest of her life after they parted ways. She had an accident that made her have trouble walking. It was a spinal injury, so he kind of helped keep up her apartment and stuff for the rest of her life. And whenever he saw a picture of her, he began crying because he was saying she could have done so much more, because she kind of became an alcoholic and just kind of a good time girl that fell into hard times. And he kind of just began to love her more like a daughter in the end, and it just really broke his heart to see her bad end. But she loved him even to the end too, and was there crying at his funeral. And so even though their relationship was kind of tempestuous and very volatile to begin with, I think they really did love each other.
Mm-hmm.
It's just sad that it broke up his and Anna Held union, but they had their own problems, so I don't know if it really would have lasted even if Lillian hadn't come into the picture.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Well, yes, and it's interesting because, you know, the Ziegfeld Club, my grandmother danced in the Ziegfeld Follies, and I think I mentioned to you in another conversation that what you have her picture in your book in one of the scenes of Ziegfeld with a group of the dancers, the chorus girls from that year. So my grandma was around for a lot of this. She had heard stories about a lot of these people that we're talking about now, and I'm my grandmother was the corresponding secretary of the Ziegfeld Club, and then my mother became the corresponding secretary. I was the corresponding secretary, and then became president and now executive director as we relaunched the organization. But when you talk about Lillian and Lorraine, we have in our archives letters from her, and you know, she was very destitute in the end. It was really sad. I mean, she had really been, her life had been ruined by drugs and alcohol. And yes, the spinal injury you talk about, she lived on the Upper West Side, and she slipped on the ice in the wintertime and broke her back, and just really was, then from then on it was really downhill. But she would write to the Ziegfeld Club, and the Ziegfeld Club helped her financially and really, you know, helped her get through a lot of really tough times, which is what we know Ziegfeld would have wanted. But the Ziegfeld Club was started by Billy Burke in 1936 to help women who had performed in the Ziegfeld Follies, because Ziegfeld did pay his dancers, his performers, very well. And he was, you know, really a good person to work for. The thing was that when the Follies ended and the world changed so much with the Depression and World War II and all the things that happened after the death of Ziegfeld, so many of these women had no, I hate this expression, but no plan B. And so the Ziegfeld Club was there to help them. And Billy Burke created the Ziegfeld Club in the name of Florence Ziegfeld to help the women who would perform for him as a sisterhood, which is what our organization is. And we're just so thrilled that, you know, that you and your sister, Cynthia and Sarah, that you've written this book that is just such a love letter to Ziegfeld, but also brutally honest. And I just loved it. I can't encourage anyone more to read it if they're at all interested in theater history. And I look at Ziegfeld and I realize that the Ziegfeld Follies and Ziegfeld are the DNA of Broadway and Hollywood today. You can trace so many people that are working in the business today back to Ziegfeld, their parents, their grandparents, all the people that met, and the marriages and the relationships that came from meeting through Ziegfeld or being part of that world. So I think it's just really the foundation of what we have today in show business.
We truly believe that Ziegfeld was basically the father of the modern American musical, and he created truly American shows. Before him, the bulk of shows were heavily influenced by European productions, but he filled his shows with mostly just American music, ragtime, jazz, and the shows were original. They weren't based. They were rarely based on European shows, except his shows for Anna Howe. But when he became a big success, his shows were just completely American and really spotlighted the American dream, that you could you know, rise from a shop girl to a rich showgirl just through sheer ambition and pluck. And I'm talking specifically about the show Sally here.
Sally, yeah, look for the silver lining. Absolutely. Starring Marilyn Miller.
Yeah.
And
countless Hollywood musicals as well are like Ziegfeld shows. There's many movies that mention Ziegfeld or are basically just representations of the Ziegfeld Follies, like Ziegfeld Girl starring Judy Garland and Lana Turner. And even films like Easter Parade or Singing in the Rain, they have living mannequin sequences. If anybody has seen Easter Parade and The Girl I Love is on a magazine cover sequence, it shows women posing in kind of still life, they look like paintings. And Ziegfeld, he pioneered that in his shows, and it's a really great tableau form of art that's just beautiful to look at, and it just makes film and theater like a piece of art. It's not just entertainment, it's art.
When he was working with Joseph Urban on those gorgeous sets.
Yes, he really just made sure everything was artfully and intelligently done. He said that the Ziegfeld touch was wonder and intelligence, and I think that you can see that in reading about his shows and looking at pictures. Everything was splendid and done intelligently. He just really loved Ziggy. And once when he was delirious, and when he was sick and in a delirium, and his friend John Cockrider, I believe it was, said that he just kept on murmuring, "All that beauty, all that beauty." So beauty was really his always on his mind, and he just wanted to make the world a more beautiful place. And even if it was kind of seemed out of reach, he just wanted to make it seem like it really was. And I think he always kept that belief, kind of like a childlike belief that everything would be okay and everything was beautiful. That was really neat to learn.
Where do you think that came from? I mean, growing up in Chicago, his father was a classically trained musician and had the music school. Where do you think that came from? Do you think there was a moment in Ziegfeld's life, or was he just programmed that way?
Well, he grew up and surrounded by, I suppose you'd say, beauty, you know, beautiful classical music. So he really wanted to break away from that tradition. And I think it was at the Chicago World's Fair of 1893 that it really kind of hit him that he wanted to create beauty. He exploited strongman Eugene Sandow, who was kind of like a glorified man instead of a glorified girl. But he got into kind of like more vaudeville and burlesque at that time. He saw it, and he saw Anna Held performing in music halls in London, and he saw what was being done, but he was thinking this could be more tasteful, because with his education and background, he knew how to make things tasteful, and he was thinking, I can take this and I can make it beautiful. I can make it classy.
Right. But also going to Europe, going to London and Paris, right? That also really opened his eyes a lot when he met Anna Held. I mean, the original Follies, the Anna Held Follies, right?
Yes. She kind of helped him think of the idea. She suggested that he do something like this. Folie Bergère, I can't pronounce it.
Folie Bergère,
Yeah. So, and Anna was never actually in one of the Follies,
right.
But homages were made to her in them. But he made an homage to Anna in several Follies. The first chorus girls were called the Anna Held Girls.
And he made her quite a big celebrity in New York. I mean, she was really very well received here. So he was definitely a star maker. So, well, okay,
yes.
well, well,
yes.
This has been so fascinating, and I'm going to possibly, if you agree, maybe we could talk again, and we'll do another recording, and we'll do some more background on Flo and Ziegfeld. If the listeners would like to check back again, we'll add another installment to our conversation, if that's of interest to you.
Yes, we would love to.
Okay, great. So I just wanted to remind the listeners that we're talking to Sarah and Cynthia Brideson, the authors of the brand new biography of the world's greatest producer. It's called Ziegfeld and His Follies. They've also written the book Also Starring, which is a compilation of essays. The essays are different celebrities of the golden era of Hollywood. Is that right?
Specifically about character actors of old Hollywood.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. And we have the forthcoming book, the biography of Gene Kelly, and they are also working on a compilation of Hollywood costume designer, female pioneering costume designers. So your subject matters are absolutely brilliant. You sound very busy. So I'm so grateful to have time to talk to you. And let's talk again soon, okay?